to a town in, what was it now? It was 2019 then, that the town would have grown over the years. It looks much the same as it did many years ago. It's really extraordinary. Listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, on the web. Just think about the untold countless lives that were destroyed, that were lost in that area right there. Usually we would be bringing you Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole. Harriet is off this week and will be back next week with a brand new show. Coming up next, we have a wonderful, wonderful program that we're going to bring to you. It's a show about black theater and actors and all of that. And it's called Backstage Stories. We'll send that, we'll play that. Backstage Stories, excuse me. We'll play that for you now here on WBAI. But do remember to call in and support WBAI at 212-209-2950.
Bird's here, Chief. He thinks that Harvey's innocent.
Well, I'll be damned.
Could I talk to you about it in private? Huh?
No, you can't talk to me about it in privacy because I got Obers' wallet right here in my hand. We took it from Harvey Obers. You don't think he gave it to him, do you?
I don't know, but Obers could have come along after the crime, found it, picked it up. I don't know.
That's what the boys said he did.
Well, I'm sorry, man, but I say different.
Well, when I examined the deceased, it was obvious that the fatal blow was struck from an angle of 17 degrees from the right, which makes it almost certain the person who did it is right-handed.
So what?
Well, Harvey's left-handed, Chief. Everybody in town knows that.
Yeah, that's what we figured out, Chief. Harvey's a lefty, uh-huh.
Well, you're pretty sure of yourself, ain't you, Virgil? Virgil, that's a funny name for a nigger boy that comes from Philadelphia. What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
Mr. Tibbs? Well, Mr. Wood, take Mr. Tibbs. Take him down to the depot, and I mean boy like now.
In the heat of the night, seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah. In the heat of night, I'm feeling motherless somehow. Stars with evil eyes stare from the skies on me and bright.
Welcome to Backstage Stories on WBAI New York. I'm Marcia Pendleton, the producer and host, and tonight we are celebrating and remembering artist and activist Sidney Poitier. What you just heard was a clip from the groundbreaking film In the Heat of the Night, followed by its theme song performed by the late, great Ray Charles. Joining us tonight in the celebration are Michael Dinwiddie, playwright, composer, actor, musician, scholar. He doesn't know it, but he's the resident scholar of Backstage Stories. He is also an associate professor at NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study. We also have with us celebrated and honored screenwriter and playwright, Richard Wesley, who also wrote two films directed by Mr. Poitier, and he is also an associate professor at NYU, but he's at the Tisch School for the Arts. And finally, we have Patrick L. Riley, an independent producer, host, and writer, whose clients include or have included projects for The Oprah Winfrey Show and The Oprah Winfrey Network. You can also catch his work on Inspired with Patrick L. Riley, and it's seen on Crew TV. And welcome, gentlemen. I love the fact that I have these beautiful men speaking about another beautiful brother. Welcome to Backstage Stories.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us, Marcia. We speak your name, Sidney Poitier.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to start off with some context, and we're going to look to Michael to do that for us, to give us some general information about Mr. Poitier's background, his life in the theater, because people forget he started in the theater right here in New York City. And I also want to find out about the circumstances that enabled Mr. Poitier to emerge as a movie star in the 50s and the early 60s. What was it going on politically and culturally and historically and economically and socially? And could anybody else have done that other than Sidney? So take it away, Michael.
Well, Marcia, I only have an hour, so
yes.
I don't know what you expect me to do here, but I'll do what I can, okay?
But make it quick.
Okay, sure. Well, so first of all, thank you so much for having me, and in such distinguished company, I'm just delighted to be here. You know, Sidney Poitier, I have to tell the truth and say I grew up on Sidney Poitier. Mm-hmm. You know, as a little kid, I saw all the movies. He was someone, my parents could take me to see the movies that he was in, you know, because they were so uplifting and so amazing and so incredible. He had a presence that we all talk about and we all understand. But I say all that to say that in some ways, I'm a big fan, and I'm really grateful for the fact that I grew up seeing his performances. I didn't realize, you know, when you're a kid, you don't realize, oh, that's the black person. You don't realize that. You just identify and you connect with it, but you don't think, oh, this is groundbreaking. Oh, this is something different. You know, To Sir With Love was not about that. To me, it was interesting that they were speaking a different accent. It was English accent, not African American or something like that. So I guess I should just start off with the fact that Sidney started off life with a different accent. He was born in the Bahamas. Well, I'm wrong. He was born in Miami. His parents were Bahamian. He was born 3 months premature on February 20th, 1927. They were in Miami. His father was a cab driver. His mother worked. They were humble people, had seven brothers and sisters. There were seven children in the family. And the accident of his birth, I think, is one of the things that really helped propel his career, because he was born in the United States, so he had American citizenship.
Right.
But he was so lucky because his family went back to Miami. Well, they went back to Bahamas after 3 months. They stayed there to really nurse him and take care of him. And then they went back, and he grew up on Cat Island. And when he describes what it was like, that it was a place where there was no television. Many of the modern conveniences that we know were not there. And so I don't even want to say it was a simple life, because that's the wrong way to say it. It was a life that was closer to the earth, a life that our grandparents and great-grandparents probably experienced more of. And so it gave him a kind of rootedness in his culture and himself. And he talks about the fact that he could look out at the sea and it was beautiful. And he could hear, when he looked at the sea, he could hear his mother's voice, the calling of mom. And so that's kind of, he's rooted in that. And so it also bespeaks a kind of value system that he came into. He wasn't your Hollywood actor. He was not, that was not his consciousness at all. But it's fascinating to me that when he's 10 years old, he moves back to the United States, or his family brings it back. And then when he's in the South, and he realizes he just can't take it. And so when he's at the age of 16, he goes north. He goes to New York City. And I don't, you know, I hope you guys have read his books, because I have not. And my mom has, so I'm sure Patrick will, you know, elucidate this and everything. Because I'm just wondering, why did he want to become an actor? What was the choice there? He had such a serious kind of meaning. He was such an interesting person. So I'll look for that answer. But he goes to the North. He goes and auditions for the American Negro Theater. Now, the American Negro Theater was based in Harlem. It had been started in 1940. a number of prominent African-American artists. And it was really kind of like the place to go. And he walks and he auditions. And I was not there, so I don't know how his audition went, other than to say that he was not accepted. His accent was too thick. They couldn't understand what he was saying. He had a kind of patois that was unintelligible to these. And, you know, I don't want to say they laughed at him, because I don't know that. I mean, maybe Patrick or Richard will have a sense of what happened with that. But he was devastated. So he went away. He got jobs as a dishwasher. He slept on the roofs of buildings. He was really had a really difficult time in New York. And he started to train. He started to learn and listen to English. He listened to the radio. He worked with a kind waiter in a place where he worked, who helped him to read and to just start to learn to use the English in the way that we are more accustomed to in this country. He auditioned again for the American Negro Theater, and this time he was accepted into the American Negro Theater, which is really kind of, in some ways, the beginning of his career. You know, and I say all that to say that it was in the theater that he got his grounding. You know, one of the roles that we know him for is A Raisin in the Sun, but we have to understand that he did A Raisin in the Sun on the stage before it was a film. He worked with, he insisted that the stage play have a black director. That's the beginning of Lloyd Richards' prominence. Lloyd Richards, who becomes the director of the Yale School of Drama, the dean of the Yale School of Drama, and who also runs the Eugene O'Neill Memorial Writers, and has an incredible career and brings us along to August Wilson. But I say all that to say that Sidney was someone who was opening doors for other people all the time. In 1952, he did a piece with, it was a recital. It was kind of I have to look it up and get it correct, because I don't want to get it wrong, but it was basically, he met Lorraine Hansberry in 52. So he met her many years before he did that. And remember, Lorraine Hansberry is in very, very progressive circles, and so is Sidney. Now, one of the things in my research, which I did not know, and I should have known it, but, you know, and I'd heard all my life that, you know, he had been knighted. And I was like, how can you be knighted if you're not, you know, but he was Sir Sidney Poitier, you know, in 1974, Queen Elizabeth. So what we realize is that his talent really propelled him. The films we think of with him are Blackboard Jungle, 1955. Mm-hmm. The one that makes him a really breakout star is The Defiant Ones with Tony Curtis. Interesting tidbit is that Tony was at the time the big star, and he insisted that he and Sidney have the same billing on that, which tells you kind of a spirit that's happening in Hollywood. In 1948, when Sidney's really starting to break through in terms of his career, in terms of the kinds of offers he's getting, this is where the Democratic Party comes up with the civil rights platform for the first time. So timing is really interesting in terms of his career and his life. When Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which we saw, which we all, you know, thought was kind of like, okay, it's okay film, but it comes out just a few months after it's legal for black people and white people, The Loving Case, 1967, to marry. So timing is really important with Sidney. I'm really trying to jump through a lot here.
It's okay. Yeah. You're doing great.
I want to make sure I leave time for us to really share in these ideas, mm-hmm. because he won so many awards. I mean, he received the Kennedy Center Award. I did not know that he was the Bahamian ambassador to Japan for 10 years. Which is, I mean, you read this stuff and you go like, wow. And then, you know, the thing that just touched me, and Marcy and I talked about this before, so I'm going to embarrass myself. I mean, he made all these great movies, and Liz the Field, of course, I remember that as a child. That was like really beautiful. I just, you know, it was like a beautiful thing that I was like, you know, I was like 9 years old or 10 years old watching this beautiful story that I didn't understand the story, but it was just really wonderful. But my favorite movie, and I hope everybody will tell their favorite movie.
Yes.
This is no shade on Richard at all, because Richard's movies are fabulous and wonderful and amazing. But my favorite was a movie called The Long Ships, in which Sidney Poitier plays like a. And that's the one where I started to go like, oh, okay, you're bringing it now, because he was like the Sultan in charge and he had the harem. And Richard Widmark, who he had worked with earlier, basically stars as like basically a slave in the movie who messes with his harem and stuff like that. But I remember that so well because I had never seen that kind of role with a person of color. So mm-hmm. what Sidney brought, and I know my time is almost up right now, but what Sidney brought was a kind of innate dignity, an understanding of himself as a person. he never, you get the feeling that he never compromised who he was. There were times he had to do things in Hollywood because that's Hollywood, you know, that you have to really make adjustments. But when you look at his first directing film, Buck and the Preacher, you really understand a kind of conscience. I was born in Oklahoma, so I grew up with cowboys. I grew up with black cowboys. I knew those stories. And to see that and to see, but also see the chicanery, to see that they were real people, to see that these characters could really go back and forth in terms of nobility, in terms of being gangster. I mean, what's going to happen? And then to see the Native American element brought in. These are the things I think that Sidney brought to the American theater. He brought a kind of richness of experience, and the fact that he was from an outside universe, he could start to take apart the stereotypes. I mean, I'm going to, you know, it's like the ways in which you think of the fact that Obama was from an outside space. He could look at blackness in a way that was very different. And at the same time, very much of the culture, because he had come from a place where people were very rooted in their Africanness, in their blackness. And so those are some of the things that hit me with, you know, Sidney. I didn't even mention Paris Blues, mm-hmm. you know, which Patrick had alluded to a little earlier when we were talking before we went on, which was really a beautiful love story and a story in which we get to see Sidney. You know, Imani Perry talks about this idea of black formalism. You know, people talk about respectability, but it's not respectability. It's the idea there's a certain way you act in certain places that shows who you are. And I have to say that when I think about Sidney Poitier and I think about the ways in which he conducted himself, and the film roles he chose and the way his life unfolded, I have to say that he understood the role he was playing, and he was willing to be and do the Jackie Robinson, the all the things that it took to make people proud, to make himself proud, and to be comfortable with who he was. So to me, I'm going to stop there. I think that kind of puts
that is an excellent place to stop. Thank you so very much, Michael. And I, too, was struck by the fact that I had no idea that he was the ambassador to Japan. I was just like, what?
Exactly.
And the only reason I knew, this is Patrick Riley. I know it's not my turn to speak, but I...
No, it's good.
But I want to say this part. I was born in Tokyo, so I knew only in the context that, you know, I pay attention to things about Japan, even though I hadn't been there since 1972.
Oh, wow.
Does anybody have the answer to the question that Michael posed earlier? Do we know why Sidney became an actor?
Sidney addressed that in an interview one time. He's kind of told this story in different kinds of ways, but he was really insulted when he was told, when he was rejected that first time at the American Negro Theater. It was how he was rejected. Mm-hmm. His accent was not simply criticized, it was belittled. And in effect, the person was belittling him and basically told him that he could never be an actor, and that he should probably go off somewhere and get himself a job as a dishwasher or something like that. Sidney's sense of himself dictated that if he undertook any kind of a task, he always tried to be the best that he could possibly be at doing it. And so his decision to become an actor was born out of that insult and this sense that, well, I'll show them. Not only will I come back and nail the audition the next time, but I will be the best actor that they have ever seen. So in that particular interview that I remember, you know, that was a big motivating factor for him. He was just looking for a job. He was looking for something to do. He had gotten to New York, as Michael indicated, and in those early days that he was in New York, you know, Sidney was sleeping on roofs of buildings, and he had virtually no money. And he saw that article in the Amsterdam News, I think it was, and you know, looking for, they were looking for actors at the American Negro Theater. So he's, well, I guess I'd make, that's a job. You know, maybe I can go down here and get something. And well, you know, then, all those other things took place. And the irony, of it all is, you know, Sidney was in a class with Harry Belafonte. He was in with, Frederick O'Neill, who later became the first Black president of Actors Equity, Stanley Green, a very, very fine character actor, was in that grouping. Ruby Dee and Ossie were in there, and Sidney was the one that emerged out of all of that as the actor who was called to Hollywood for that role in Cry the Beloved Country. And also, No Way Out, the, I guess you could really call that one his breakout role, initially, you know, in the 50s, in 1950. And Michael, you kind of answered Marcia's, earlier question.
Marcia. No Marcia here.
You know, let's get that straight right off the bat. You answered Marcia's earlier question about how did Sidney become a star when you were talking about that positioning that he had as something of an outsider, of not necessarily being burdened with all of the baggage that American-born Africans have to carry with us wherever we go. I know in some of the show business circles that I was, you know, that I've been in over the years, one of the comments that always was made whenever Sidney's name came up was that there had always been this feeling that James Edwards was supposed to be the one.
Wow.
I mean, because he had sort of broken out in that film,
the war
Home
film,
of Brave.
Home of the Brave, yeah,
Home of the Brave. And he's just as handsome as Sidney, a little shorter, but just as handsome as Sidney, right. And very charismatic on screen. But some other things happen. I don't particularly want to go into them because no. I don't know all the full details. But James Edwards did not emerge. It was Sidney.
It was Sidney who emerged.
Part of it, I think, was an outgrowth of James Edwards was having to deal with the rage that all native-born Black people carry with them. And Sidney found ways, since he came from the Bahamas, and as he once said, I think it was in his book, This Life, and I also saw him make mention of this in an interview that he did on television from Texas, of all places. He explained that he grew up in a space where he had always seen Black people taking
responsibility and
being in positions of leadership.
Exactly. And can we come back to that at some point in this conversation? Because that is a very important point. And that is a point that I hear a lot of people from the English speaking Caribbean speak about, is that the fact that they were traumatized when they came to the United States because they were in a space where they saw Black people doing everything, filling every position. Mm-hmm. This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. We are celebrating the life of Sidney Poitier with Michael Dinwiddie, Richard Wesley, and Patrick L. Riley. We're going to get into some of the things that Richard did with Sidney Poitier. Mm-hmm. But we're going to hear a little bit of the song Let's Do It Again by the Staple Singers. Good loving. When I was a kid, I had no idea what they were singing about. I had no clue. It took me a little while to catch up, and I was just like, oh, okay.
That's what? Do what again?
Do what again?
So I don't remember exactly whose idea it was to call Curtis Mayfield. I know Sidney was and remained throughout the rest of his life very close to Quincy Jones.
Yes.
And he was anxious, like a lot of other people in town in those days, he really wanted to have Quincy do a soundtrack for a film that he was directing. But Quincy was moving away from doing soundtracks at that time. And I suspect Quincy kind of suggested some names, and one of those names may have been Curtis Mayfield, and which excited the daylights out of me when I heard that Curtis was going to be writing the soundtrack. But here's the deal. Curtis got distracted. He had a lot of different things that he had to do. There was a lot that he had on his plate. And he had lost a lot of time. He was supposed to have delivered a soundtrack to Sidney at one particular date. That date came and went and went and went and went. And by the time Sidney got on the phone with him and was saying, "Yo, what's up? We only got about 2 weeks." That's what it was. It was down to 2 weeks, the deadline. And so Curtis Mayfield had to write something up real quick and get it in there. He had the title of the script. And so he just said, "Let's do it again." And I'll put something around it. And so that's why the title song really doesn't have anything to do
with the film.
What's going on in the movie. But I remember Sidney and I were talking one time, and I said to him, especially when I heard the song, said, "Sidney, if this song is a hit, it is free advertising for the movie, because people will be coming to the theater to see the movie that goes along with this song, the same way they came to see Superfly."
Exactly.
When Curtis wrote the soundtrack to Superfly. And sure enough, Let's Do It Again went through the roof, as far as the song was concerned on the radio. And 1 month later, when the film opened, same thing.
Everybody was there.
Box office records.
Everybody was there. How did you wind up How did you wind up writing two screenplays that were directed?
Actually, four.
Oh, four screenplays directed by Sydney?
I wrote four screenplays for Sydney.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it would have been five, but the fifth one didn't get produced.
Okay. So tell,
can you name them?
Can you name them? Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, the first one was Uptown Saturday Night.
Yes.
Let's Do It Again.
Yes.
During the 1980s, Fast Forward, it was a film musical. And then in the 1990s, Mandela and the Clerk.
Right,
With Sidney and Michael Caine.
Yes.
Those four. The fifth one was also during the 70s. And because it didn't get produced, that's how a piece of the action actually got made.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
There's a story with that too, but
all right. So,
the action though.
So, how did you connect with Sydney? How did all of that happen? How does out of Howard University and out of Newark, New Jersey, mm-hmm. hook up with at that point in time one of the biggest movie stars in the world?
I was in the right place at the right time.
Okay, what places were that?
All right.
What time
developed for myself a very nice reputation as an off-Broadway playwright.
Mm-hmm.
I written a couple political dramas at the Public Theater and the old Phoenix Rep, and I was getting these very nice notices. And anyway, the wonderful actress Novella Nelson mm-hmm. Was also producing plays for Joe Papp at the Public Theater. And she put together a night of one acts, and one of the plays was mine. And I think you might remember an actress named Beverly Todd.
Yes.
Well, Beverly had starred with Sydney in at least two films, Brother John, mm-hmm. and The Lost Man.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that she and Morgan Freeman were in the one-act play that I wrote. So Sydney was in New York, and he and Harry Belafonte came to see Beverly in the play. So Sydney apparently asked her, well, who is this playwright? And she told him about me because I wasn't at the theater that night. The play was running. It was okay. I was in New Jersey. I just got married. So I was staying home being a family man. We had a little baby and everything. So I was at home.
How old were you, Richard, when this happened? How old were you?
I think I was 27.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I was 27 around then. And, Sydney, asked about me, and Beverly told him. And several months later, out of the blue, I got a telephone call from a Sydney secretary asking me to come to his office. He was based in New York in those days. To come to his office, he'd like to sit down and talk to me about a project he had in mind. Mind you, at this time, I was one of several writers he was talking to. It wasn't just like I was the only one. There were several writers he was speaking to. And I was basically in a competition. The one who would come back to him with the sharpest realized idea for a story was going to get the job. He knew what he wanted the story to be about. He knew that he had a protagonist who was a working class guy who had to be in some place that he had no business being. And he also knew that the fellow was going to have to win a lottery, and he had the winning ticket in his wallet, and that he would lose his wallet and spend the rest of the film trying to get that wallet back. Those were the broad parameters of the story. Mm-hmm. So can you give me a story that, that meets all of that criteria, where I can fit all of those things into. And I want to be able to use as many of the top Black comedians and comedic actors as I possibly can. I'm going to be out of, I think he told me, yeah, I'm going to be out of town for 2 weeks. And when I come back at the end of that 2 week period, can you deliver something for me? And I said, yes. And he said, fine. If I like it, you have the job. If not, well, perhaps we'll meet again on something else someday. And
what were those 2 weeks like for you?
I had no idea what I was going to write. I lied. I was not going to be sitting in a room with Sidney Poitier and tell him I couldn't possibly do this. So I said, yeah, I can do this, you know, and got down on that street and looked up into the heavens and said, Lord, what have I done? I stand out there on Broadway and I was just like, oh, man. And I spent most of those 2 weeks just trying to think of the story. And I knew that, and that deadline was looming larger and larger and larger on that horizon and everything. Patrick and Michael, both of you nod their heads because they know exactly what this is
like. We know about deadlines, brother. We know about deadlines.
They know exactly what this is like.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened was I was, in those days, I was a member of the New Lafayette Theater up in Harlem. And one of our actors, Sonny Jim Gaines, was having a conversation with some other people, and I kind of overheard it and wound up stepping into the circle. Make a long story short, the night that Muhammad Ali had his big fight with Jerry Quarry in Atlanta, was after the Supreme Court said he could fight again, there was a players' ball. Where all the hustlers and all the all the gangsters and everything had come to Atlanta, and they had their own party after the fight, and a couple of guys from Harlem, masked, broke into the party and robbed it. They made everybody take off their clothes and put the clothes in a big pile, took all their jewelry, their money, everything, and made off into the night with it. And it was, you know, a small article. I remember reading it in the newspaper, and later on, you know, people were whispering about it all on the streets of Harlem and stuff. And Sonny started making mention of that particular story because the two perpetrators bragged about it and then promptly disappeared, and ain't nobody seen them since.
Okay.
So getting back to the thing was, I heard this story and it was like all the pieces, everything just fell into place for me.
Yeah.
I suddenly remembered an after hours place in Newark. I remembered, he said working class. That's my father. He was a laborer at the Sherwin-Williams paint factory in Newark. And I thought about a guy going to that after hours place on the night that he gets robbed. And once I had that, I had the whole story. I knew from beginning virtually to the end exactly how that story was going to go. And I wrote that treatment out in 72 hours, 3 days.
Wow.
You know, and just after that, I got it back to Sydney. And I think a couple of days went by, Sydney called me and said, young man, I want to speak to you. And that was it. Suddenly I was writing Uptown Saturday Night. That was March of 1973. And I had the script completely finished by, I think, just before July the 4th. And he went into production with it in September. And everything took off from there.
Life-changing experience.
Yeah,
we want to hear a little bit about your relationship beyond the professional with Mr. Poitier. If you can just give a little bit of that, and then I want to play some of the music from Uptown Saturday Night that I found. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sydney was a combination of I think the best way I can put it was he's like a big brother.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much like a big brother. He was only 18 years older than me. He gave me advice about the business, about screenwriting, the differences between screen and stage, talked about cars. Riding in a car with Sidney Poitier is its own special experience because Sidney has never met an accelerator that he did not believe belonged as close to the floor as possible. you know, that's the only way I can put it. You know, and he certainly loved driving with one hand on the wheel.
Oh no!
Oh boy! Okay. You know, okay.
And could do it extremely well.
And probably looked very cool and elegant doing
it. Yes, he did. He had a wonderful sense of humor. But you know, when he spent his time with me, because almost all the time that I was with Sidney was always one-on-one, and it was mostly in working circumstances. We didn't hang out or anything mm-hmm. like that. We might hang out while the work was being done, but once I finished the project, I was back in New York and he was in Los Angeles. You know, I wouldn't see him again until we started working. I would call him occasionally, and I got into this thing where every year, Sidney and I would have a conversation on the phone, or I would go and visit with him when I was in Los Angeles. Away from work, he was very congenial, very relaxed most of the time. Always planning something. And always, like I said, with me, it was always, you know, these are the things you need to be careful of. These are the things you ought to be watching out for. This is what you should know when you go into this particular room where, what's the next project you're working on? When you go in, I know this guy. I know what he's like. These are the things to say. These are the things not to say. He was always like that. He was a teacher. And like I said, you know, he was a big brother. And I learned about the business watching how he conducted business. Michael made earlier in his remarks some mention of, you know, Sidney and his appearance, or maybe it was Patrick before we went on the air, but somewhere I seem to remember somebody mentioning something about Sidney's elegance. And he was always aware of the image that he was presenting.
Okay.
So he always took care to look a certain way when he went out into public. Sidney was not into shamble. He was not into, you know, being overly casual. Even when he dressed casually, he dressed tastefully. He kind of passed a little bit of that on to me, especially when I was, in all those A-list situations in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Yeah, that was it for me.
All right. That's a beautiful, beautiful tribute. Let's hear a little bit of this Uptown Saturday Night Part 1. It is definitely from the disco era. By Bill Harris. Can we hear that? Saturday Night, Part 1 by Bill Harris.
Yeah.
This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. We are celebrating the life of Sidney Poitier with Michael Dinwiddie, Richard Wesley, and Patrick L. Riley. And we come to Patrick L. Riley, who has some wonderful stories about interviewing Mr. Poitier when he is now an icon and an elder. What was that like? Share some red carpet tea with us.
Some red carpet tea. Well, let's say, you know, the years you mentioned my longstanding client, Oprah Winfrey, through her, because he was such a mentor to her, I've had an opportunity as a field producer for the show for all these many years to do one-on-one interviews with him, a bit of red carpet at special screenings. But the moment that stands out is the weekend in Santa Barbara when Oprah was honoring all of those amazing African-American women, 20 to the tune of 25, Dr. Maya Angelou, Diane Carroll, Ruby Dee, Diana Ross, Tina Turner, on and on I could go. There were also some pretty amazing men in that room. And that went from Lionel Richie to Berry Gordy to Usher to Sidney Poitier. And really, to Richard's point about sort of how to be, you know, he was the blueprint in so many ways for the contemporary Black man, how to be elegant, eloquent, stately, present, refined. And there's this moment where, as he's walking into what I'm sure all of you know, the jungle of what a red carpet can be, where Entertainment Tonight has position one because they've gotten, you know, the cleared exclusive through publicity. And I'm position two, there to interview all of the legends and youngins and guests as they come into the ball. And I'm Oprah's camera, but there's nothing that sort of sets me apart as Oprah's camera. But what set me apart when Sidney Poitier walked onto the red carpet at the Bacara Resort and Spa was, I think, just a Black man moment. Our eyes caught. And because the positioning of Entertainment Tonight was such that they were to get the first interview, because our eyes caught, when Jan Carl approached him, he says, "I'm going to interview with the gentleman in front of me first, and then I'll come to you, Entertainment Tonight." And I thought, that is the measure of the man. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of in a room like that where easily I could maybe be made to feel less than, it would be Sidney Poitier who took the moment to make sure that moment didn't happen, not even for a second. So when I can all the things that we've spoken about in terms of his career and his philosophy for life, the intention he put into his career. That's the moment that always stands out for me. And then we got a 15-minute interview to talk not really about him, but about the women. You know, he spoke about Diane Carroll, with whom he co-starred in Paris Blues. He spoke about the women who, if they were alive, might have been there, with whom he had co-starred. So even though he had co-starred alongside Ruby Dee and we spoke her name, he spoke the name of Diana Sands, who many, you know, don't remember, but was Benita in Raisin' in the Sun. And so I thought it was just so generous that even with his memories, he spoke of Diana Ross coming to the set of For the Love of Ivy at a point where Berry Gordy was navigating her entree into Hollywood with Lady Sings the Blues. And he spoke of how, yes, there are women with whom I've worked and there are women I've admired for many years. And then he remembered how, you know, so, you know, he just was so thoughtful and so the blueprint of how any of us would want to be. But he really is the example that if you were holding on to it in the 60s, you continued to hold on to it until today. I didn't meet him until I got here in the 70s. But everything that he represents, he showed me on many of those one-on-one nights when I've had a chance to be one-on-one with him. He's just a class act, was a class act all around.
How many times did you run into him during that weekend?
That weekend, you know, the rule was that if you talk to them on the first day, don't talk to them on the second day. If you talk to them on the second day, don't bother them on the third day. We were just sort of getting a sense. Well, I didn't care what the rules were. I spoke to Sydney on day two, and I spoke to him at the gospel brunch on day three that was on Oprah's property. And in all instances, he was what Richard points out. He was just the example of how you want to be in a room. And I don't know that he considered himself, he even admitted to me that he can be shy, but as a shy person, he has sort of an observer's eye. So he's shy and compassionate. So he sort of puts that into his song and dance, and it just makes for just charming exchanges all around. Like, he made me feel like I was the only one in that room. But I did observe as he went down the press line that night at the Oprah's ball, he continued to be gracious to everyone. I have one more quick memory. When I met him in 2009 in Hollywood, premiere of Lee Daniels' Precious, which, you know, Tyler Perry and Oprah also were executive producers on that project. I happened to be seated near him in the theater. And so afterwards, we were able to have a little moment, a high. And we just so happened to be exiting our aisle, approaching Monique. This would be the role for which she would win the Oscar for supporting actress. And so I say to him, because we had already sort of had our Remember Me from Legends. I also worked on the South Africa documentary for the opening of the Girls Academy, that kind of thing. And then we get to the point where I say, have you met Monique? He says, no, I haven't met her. So I happen to be sort of the one to facilitate this introduction of Sidney Poitier, his daughter, Sidney, who was his date that night, introducing them to Monique, who then introduced her husband, Sidney, to the two Sidneys. It was like a whole moment. You know what I mean?
Okay. Three Sidneys.
And I captured the moment of Sidney, the three Sidneys and Monique staying around long enough to sort of take a few shots. And then to finally, after maybe four times meeting him and being an audience with him before, I finally got my picture. So I got my picture with him on Hollywood Boulevard, which I think is also symbolic, you know. So I will forever speak the name of Sidney Poitier, not for all of the ways in which he has moved the world, but in some very specific ways in which he moved me. And I think that is how he moved in life. You know
I have to just say one thing. I mean, Patrick, you made me realize, we're sitting here, one of us is born in the 40s, one is born in the 50s, one is born in the 70s. I don't know when Marcia was born, but what's interesting to me
is... Don't worry about it.
We shared memories of this person who kind of transcends time in our lives. Because when you said, I had a black man moment, I thought to myself, well, I had a black kid moment. You know, Richard had a black career moment. I mean, we all had these things. And so I just wanted to say that. And the last thing I want to say is I had forgotten all that fabulous music that came out of his movies for someone who's tone deaf. I mean, that's one of the issues, when Marcia's playing that music, I'm remembering, wow, what an incredible legacy that gave us as well. So,
well, who he is as a director in the 70s, you know, including Buck and the Preacher, it was about inclusion and expansion. You know, the opportunity that Richard got, it was the opportunity for the wonderful soundtracks. It was the opportunity for his peers and all of them to navigate in this popular commercial realm at a time where blaxploitation was happening kind of in a different way. And this was really the antidote. This was the compliment. Right. This was him saying, I get what the times are doing, but we can also do something with that spirit, but we can keep it elegant. We can keep it, you know, something that everyone can enjoy and understand, you know, above board. And I think that's who he continued to be beyond even directing. You know, that's why Stir Crazy, that 100 million plus, you know,
I'm just saying.
And that's why, Marcy, there's one thing we haven't mentioned. We have to mention it's the first African-American to win an Academy Award as Best Actor.
Absolutely.
So that's
absolutely. Also, he was also the first African-American director to direct a movie that scored $100 million at the box office.
Yes, so a groundbreaker in many ways. So very quickly, we have come to the end of this program. The first time you saw Sidney on screen or the first time you became aware of him, favorite film, and final thoughts. For me, my favorite film was To Sir With Love. It was the first film that I took myself to. I took my little money and went to see the film, and I fell in love with him all over again. He is one of the few artists that has been with me since I was a child through my adulthood and now being an older, what they call an older adult. Mm-hmm. I absolutely adored him, and please believe me, my heart was broken when I found out that he passed. I want to say that we are going to be celebrating Mr. Poitier's life with a special initiative. It's going to be on the date of his 95th birthday, which is Sunday, February 20th. Yes. And you'll be hearing more about that. Right now, I want to thank Patrick L. Riley, Richard Wesley, and Michael Dinwiddie for this wonderful, wonderful hour. And we're going to my favorite songs from a Sidney Poitier film. And it is with To Sir With Love.
Absolutely.
This has been To Sidney With Love. Thank you for listening. Please join us next week for Backstage Stories. Have a great week. And please remember to be in service. He was also an activist, a civil rights activist. Please remember him and the work that many artists did to make sure that we could step through the doors that birthday.
And Mars, the documentary that's coming, and there's a play, Sidney, based on the second biography, Measure of a Man. All of those things will keep his legacy alive. On the Great White Way.
On the Great White Way.
Yeah.
All right. Have a great week, everyone.
that was a special presentation.